As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking transfers and a few clubs making some slightly rushed and panicked decisions towards the end of this window. We'll also be talking captaincy. Does it matter as much as it used to? And we'll be discussing Ben Foster's retirement from football and the raising standards in the Football League. We'll also be talking Everton and Aston Villa. And joining me, Tom Clark, to discuss all of that is Chief Correspondent for the Sunday Times and the Times, Martin Samuel, Football Correspondent for the Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and everyone's favourite former left-back turned football writer, Gregor Robertson. Chaps, before we get into all of that that I've already outlined, we have to react to the news of Mason Greenwood and his departure from Manchester United. Obviously, we discussed the sensitivities around the issue last week in great, great detail, so I don't want to go over too much old ground. But it is incredibly difficult now, isn't it? Manchester United and the player and his family have all taken this decision that he's going to move on and move away from the club. But what now has become the big question for Paul Hurst and all the journalists covering this week on The Times. Martin, you've spoken quite passionately on this podcast and in your columns about Manchester United's duty of care towards the player. That has become part of the reporting in terms of what they do with him, where they send him. Do you think that's right? And do you think that comes into it as well in terms of what club he goes to next?
I'm not sure they're going to have enough options, really, to, you know, to start weighing one club up against another club. You know, so far, there doesn't seem to be too many clubs queuing up. In the piece that I wrote earlier in the week, I said about Saudi Arabia, because people go, oh, Saudi Arabia is a natural destination. And you're thinking, not really, because the whole point of the Saudi Arabia project is to try to burnish their image, to try to win hearts and minds on friends and influence and all of that. I'm not quite sure that Mason Greenwood is, you know, Michael Emanuele is in charge of that. You know, if Michael Emanuele was Chelsea, would he be trying to sign Mason Greenwood? No, he wouldn't. So I don't see that that's his move for the Saudi League. Then people were talking about Roma. Roma distanced themselves immediately. I think it's quite presumptuous on our part to start listing all these countries that we think have got somehow lower standards than us. And right from the start, and this is why I said about it's Manchester United's duty to make this work, and I know that's a minority view, but that was one of the reasons. Because if you are saying Mason Greenwood cannot play for our club, why should he be able to play for your club?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, another issue, Johnny, which Paul Hurst has raised in his reporting, is around the fact that, you know, a lot of United sources that Paul's talked about have said, this was or is a £100 million player, and just in terms of his football, talking this. But obviously, it's also a player who hasn't played any football for a long time. So if you're a club looking at him and taking that chance in terms of the PR and the politics and the image issue, you've also got to ask, am I getting the Mason Greenwood that we saw burst onto the scene?
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't played in 18 months, and I think, like many, I watched the footage of him training and from what you can glimpse, he doesn't look like a player that's exactly ready to play right now. That's part of it. I suspect, for the reasons Martin said, that United might be facing a position where they release him at the end of this month to allow him to move on as a free agent. But again, like Martin said, any buying club or club wants to sign him will face exactly the same issues that United faced and decided that they couldn't surmount in their decision to no longer work with him, as it were. All their announcement and decision has done is really kick the can down the road, I think, for Mason Greenwood. And as we said here last week, you know, we live in an age of transparency. We live in an age where it's not like the old days where someone in authority can just tell people how it is and then they'll accept it. I think people want to make their own minds up about things these days. And in the age of social media, what they see and what they hear is extremely important. So we know what's out there about Mason Greenwood that came out on social media. And until there's an answer to that, until that's explained in a way that satisfies people, and Manchester United have clearly decided they couldn't do so, and they couldn't bring Mason Greenwood to a press conference, and they couldn't have the chief executive sit down and tell us exactly why, because then their statement says Mason Greenwood's innocent of everything, blah, blah, blah. And of course, he is in the eyes of the law, but they haven't explained things, and that might be right or wrong, but that's the reality of the world now. Supporters and the public won't be happy until they can have an explanation for what's out there.
And just further to John's point there, that while you're waiting for him to get fit, so while you're waiting for this supposed benefit of getting a £100 million player for next to nothing, while you're waiting for that to happen, what is going on outside your football club is this raging argument and demonstrations and all that. All of that will come with it. And you've got 2 months maybe or a month or something before there's any actual benefit. And in that period of time, that's all you've got. All you've got is the negativity.
And I think football's is behind on this. It is behind on the strength of people's feeling about issues around gender violence and women's rights and so on. United clearly were. Otherwise, they'd have made this decision very, very early and been a lot clearer about it. But the fact that the Saudi League can signal to us that actually we can't sign him because it would compromise our efforts in the women's game. The fact that Roma are rushing to distance themselves, that tells you the problem that Mason Greenwood is going to face when he signs for anyone else. Any club buying him is going to have to answer exactly the same. I think in many countries, not just in Britain, as we've already seen, we'll have to answer this backlash.
Yeah, well, it's certainly going to be one of the big talking points of the next week or so as we head towards the end of the transfer window. We're going to move on now and talk about Manchester City, all their interest and rumours coming late in the window. They're normally a club who get their deals done, get the players in. Reading this morning on the Times website, Paul Hirst writing the interest in Wolves, Matias Nunes and Crystal Palace, Eberechi Eze. We were talking before coming on the pod in our little planning chat, Gregor. It's very unlikely.
Shining light on magic there, you know, that this is planned.
Yeah, come on. We do a little bit of planning.
Just you wait around for it. So just, it's not planned.
just you wait for the quiz questions later, Martin.
Yeah, that's definitely not planned.
But this is quite unlike City, isn't it, Gregor, in terms of it seems a little bit rushed, a little bit panicked, a little bit Chelsea-esque, shall we say?
Yeah, I think in a few ways, even the profile of the players, you see them going for a Wolves midfielder, Crystal Palace attacking midfielder, and a blisteringly quick winger in Jeremy Doku as well. So I think there's a profile, and also, as you say, the kind of slightly panicked, desperate appearance of some of it as well. Part has to do with the Saudi Arabia's emergence as well. You know, I think probably a lot of this has been accelerated. Riyad Mahrez leaving. That's the same is true for several clubs in the Premier League now. And obviously Kevin De Bruyne's injury. So it is definitely, you know, some transfer activity that wasn't planned. And that makes it fascinating. I think, you know, I'd love to see someone like Eze step up to play for an elite side. Same with Elise, who obviously was linked with Chelsea before. The two players who I loved watching in the Football League. And you know, been great to watch for Palace too, but it is something new for a club like Manchester City, who normally seem to be so well planned, and often they surprise you too sometimes with transfers, but in a way where it'll be someone from, I don't know, Brazil or you know, a kind of Portuguese league, whatever. Players that, you know, they're not familiar to us in the Premier League. It's quite rare, although Grealish is one example, but it's quite rare that they kind of go and try and cherry pick the best players in the Premier League too.
Johnny, how do you think Pep Guardiola fits into all of this? Because it just strikes me that, you know, thinking about Jeremy Doku, Paul Hirst has written a profile of him, 21 years old. Guardiola's been at the club a long time. For these players, Eze, for example, if he was to move, that would be a big thing. I'll get to work with Pep Guardiola. You know? And you go back to the famous Manchester United Robin Van Persie situation where Van Persie talked about how slightly fuming he was that he joined Manchester United and only got 1 year of one of the great managers.
Yeah.
Do we think this is part of Pep Guardiola going, you know, phase three, phase four, whatever it would be?
Well, I think it tells us what we already know, that he's an incredible football purist who loves technique and skill. And like, you know, he's interested in Paqueta, for example. The players he goes for are really aesthetic, skill players. But there's a point to that, which is his game system's always been based on creating one-on-one opportunities, overloads, and then opportunities that skillful players can exploit. And he does tend to go for players with brilliant one-on-one skills, dribbling skills. He went for Mahrez at a time when people were a little bit doubtful that this was a £60 million player. And for me, one of the great players of the modern era that's always been a bit underrated. So you can see with Doku, who's pure talent, pace, trickery, incredible dribbling ability, but very rough around the edges. Those players haven't always worked for Pep. So he went for Ferran Torres, who was maybe slightly similar and couldn't teach him to keep the ball well enough to stay with City. And that'll be Doku's issue. But with Eze and Nunes, the two of the most pleasing players on the eye in the Premier League, and Guardiola looks at things like, you know, can players eliminate the opposition with a pass? Can they eliminate them with a bit of skill? And that's what these guys do. But it's late in the window, isn't it? I mean, transfers aren't simple anymore. To extract any player from a Premier League club takes a process. They're starting it late.
Yeah.
Mark. Haaland also changed the way City play. So to think of Doku playing, the occasions last season where they went more direct than we've ever seen City play before. Mm. His pace alongside that is kind of quite thrilling to think about. And it is extraordinary pace. I mean, there's some great lines in Paul Hurst's piece about Mbappe talking about never seeing a player have such acceleration from a standing start. Thierry Henry saying if he's one-on-one with a player, all you can do is pray. And it kind of reminds you a bit of, I remember the first time I saw Adama Traore play for Borough in the flesh.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, your eyes widen and he's like slaloming between players who are like not even turned before he's passed them. It's just like, wow. And he has got some of that, but, you know, with the rawness as well. So, you know, to think of what Guardiola could make of him is quite exciting.
So Guardiola adding another talent, Martin. You wrote in your Tuesday column for the Times about Kevin De Bruyne's absence and what that might mean for the season. How much of these moves do you think is reactionary to that injury for De Bruyne?
Well, I think a lot of it, because it's not just about De Bruyne. It's the fact that, you know, because a lot of people were saying when I wrote that, and people go, oh, yeah, but they've lost De Bruyne in the past and it hasn't made any difference. They still won the league. You know, yeah, but they've lost De Bruyne and they've lost Gundogan and they've lost Mahrez. And at the start of the season, they haven't had Bernardo Silva either. So they've lost an entire midfield, basically. And it's the reaction to that, I think, as much as anything else. And the Saudi Arabia thing that Gregor mentioned there, that's absolutely right. I mean, Richard Masters came out a couple of weeks and said, oh, we're not worried about Saudi Arabia. And I'm thinking, well, why aren't you worried about Saudi Arabia, mate? Because we are losing players that were an asset to our league, to Saudi Arabia. We haven't lost players to another league at the level of Mahrez and guys like that. But we might lose the odd superstar to Barcelona or Real Madrid, and that would always happen.
Laporte as well.
Yeah. But Laporte, these are good players. Yeah. These are really good players.
And you look at how Mitrovic, for example, is going to be confirmed. Like, that's a club's top player gone.
Yeah. That's Fulham's best player. Yeah. That's, if you went to see Fulham and you wanted to see the best team that Fulham could put out, you'd want Mitrovic to be on that team sheet. And he's gone.
Has it made you sad, Johnny, as well, as a football correspondent, you know, wanting to watch the best players every week, you know, seeing those players leave, at the top of their
game? Yeah, it does. I mean, it particularly matters for just one of my favourite players. But, I mean, Mo Salah, Liverpool may face a fight, if not this window, over the next year to keep Mo Salah because he's so attractive to Saudi. What would the league be like without Salah? That'd be, you know, it's been a joy watching him throughout his career. So, of course, and as Martin said, it's been a long time since England has been in a position where it's a league that loses players to, in any volume elsewhere.
Well, there'll be some conflicting feelings among Premier League clubs about this because it's also a way of shifting heavy dates.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, there's a bit of a conflict, I think, in this.
Keep that FFP things on track. Now, I wanted to finish this talking to you, Johnny, about your piece in the Sunday Times. British transfer record can be a motivation, but could be a curse. Listing lots of players, and there was a quite revealing chart in there of the Premier League's biggest buys. Players like Paul Pogba, Mikhailo Mudryk, Antony, Harry Maguire. You know, some of those players that you think, oh, they didn't quite justify that fee. Romelu Lukaku as well. But your piece started with a story of Steve Daly, one that I hadn't heard before. Tell us about that.
I mean, maybe it's my, maybe I'm showing my age, but Steve Daly is the first one I, it's the first one I remember really as a kid.
City Walls.
Yeah, you know, I think 1979. So I'd have been about revealing my age. I was eight at the time. So, but yeah. Steve Daly, 1.5 million. He wasn't a massive player. He was a promising player, a good player, but not a England star or anything like that. And was bought by City for this huge amount of money. And when he was signed, he was called the $6 million man, even though 1.5 million was only $3 million. But as I said in the piece, when you become that record transfer,
it was probably, you know, it was probably near a six. In 1979, by the way, four to the pound.
Apparently,
possible.
I'm just thinking, good
to have some defence of the headline writers.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think as he found, everything becomes exaggerated when you've got that tag, and you're judged in a different way, seen in a different light. Moise Caicedo has perhaps already experienced that, where he has a, you know, less than incredible debut. He makes a late tackle, he's sent off, and there's a different level of scrutiny that if he'd done that for Brighton, but also if he just moved for £60 million. So if you look at that list, it's interesting seeing some great names, but also just as many names that you think, oh my goodness, he was a record transfer.
Well, you referenced some of those players who, the quality of some of them, Dennis Law, Brian Robson, Dennis Bergkamp, Alan Shearer, Roy Keane, Rio Ferdinand, any of those that stick out to you that, you know, record signing that absolutely justified the price tag of those?
I think Roy Keane did. I think Brian Robson did. I think Alan Shearer did.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. But they're getting bigger and bigger, these fees now, so it becomes harder to justify. Do you think our you know, our perception is warped slightly? Or, you know, for me, for example, as someone a little bit younger than you, if I may, for those transfers back in the day, Roy Keane, that transfer, was that, wow, oh my God, they've spent that much, in the same way as now we're reacting to these £100 million fees? Was it as was the perception as, oh my God?
I don't think so with Roy Keane, was it? Because it was £2.5 million. It didn't move the dial a lot. The £1 million players, the first generation, like the which Steve Daly was one.
And stuff like that.
That was a wow moment, wasn't
it? Yeah, it was.
And now we're in the £100 million.
Too, I think.
That was a wow, definitely.
I think Shearer was a wow as well, because everyone expected him to go to Manchester United. Mm. You know, I mean, it was front page on the Sun that morning. Unfortunately, on that morning, it was the front page that said Shearer signs for Manchester United, and it was one word out. What are you going to do? But and so I think it was wow in that respect as well, because everyone expected him to go to United.
I think there's a lot more in the old days. There's probably a lot more whim or randomness to transfer fees, I think. And I always think of Rangers beating the Scottish transfer record with Tor André Flo, you'll remember, Gregor. And they paid £12 million for Flo. It didn't deliver at all. But it was an amazing fee to pay, because the transfer record at the time was held by Celtic, £6 million for John Hartson. And the £12 million was because David Murray just wanted to double the transfer.
Really?
Yeah. And Flo was probably the victim of that rather than the benefit.
Could have had him for £6.5 million and still beat
could
him.
Could have had him for
why not? Yeah. Let's stick another
10.
Stick another 10 on top. Well, it, absolutely fascinating. We'll see what other deals will be done in the next week or so as we head towards the end of the transfer window. Moving back into the action on the field, Aston Villa 5-0 winners against Hibernian in the first leg of their Europa Conference League playoff. Back in Europe for the first time in 13 years. A huge moment for the club and a sign of things to come, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, look, 2 points. One, it's a great shame that these Battle of Britain matches aren't what they used to be. You know, that the gulf now is so great in many ways.
No,
but
Aberdeen Burnley was the last great class.
Yeah, probably was. But I mean, it used to be. I can remember going up, I think, to a UEFA Cup match when Liverpool drew Celtic. It was quite rare.
Yeah.
Because there wasn't as much European football and there were fewer teams in Europe, so it was quite rare that you got these pairings. But even though it was a UEFA Cup game, there was a massive sort of excitement around it. It's Liverpool Celtic. And it was a tight game. It was a really great game. It was a great atmosphere, etc. And yesterday, you're thinking, oh, it's with Hibs. It's at Hibernian. You know, they'll put it up to Villa and stuff. And 5-0. And you think, that's a shame. It's a shame. It's not the same. That's the first point. And the second point is, the Conference League, if you're in it, if you're the sort of club that's in it, I'm not talking about if you're Liverpool and you end up in the Conference League or whatever. But if you're Aston Villa, this is a great tournament for you. Mm-hmm. It's a great tournament that you could win. You can end up in the Europa League. You'll see your team win a trophy. There's not enough opportunity for clubs outside that top six and probably now seven with Newcastle. There's not enough opportunity these days for them to win a trophy. The reason you can reel off every single winner of the FA Cup from when I first started paying attention to it to pretty much the beginnings of the modern era is because it was a different team every year. So you remember that it was Sunderland and it was Ipswich and it was it. Whereas now you go, okay, well, it was one of Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United or Manchester City or Arsenal. It was one of them, and they've just basically handed it round to each other like to pass the parcel. Mm. So there's not that much opportunity. If you're Aston Villa, what are you going to win?
Mm.
So this is something you can win.
Yeah.
And what a great start. So the only shame of it is there's not really a game in the second leg for the Villa fans to get excited about. There's not really, you know, it's done.
I'll come to the point on the Scots to one of you in a minute. I'll decide who. I'll tell you what, Johnny, you can have it. But Gregor, firstly, to Martin's point about the Conference League, you covered West Ham's triumph last season. Do you agree? Did it feel like that, being in those grounds, going to all these places, different stadiums that you visited, did the excitement feel like it was there? Because as Martin said, there was a bit of snobbery around the whole Thursday night, etc., not just with the Conference League, but with the Europa League as well for a while.
It felt like that in the latter stages, but let's be honest, all cup competitions are the same now in that regard, isn't it? If you're a team who's got a chance of winning it, the early rounds are just about getting through.
Mm. Yeah.
So that was true of the group stages in West Ham's. But then towards the end, you know, in the last few rounds, when there was actually a bit of jeopardy as well, there were some really great moments. That Declan Rice's goal at London Stadium, and I think the quarterfinals was like, the roof came off. That was the best atmosphere I'd seen there. Mm. And obviously the final and the celebrations and everything that we saw, we saw how much it meant to Moyes, to the team, to all the fans. So absolutely, and for a club like Villa too, it can be seen as a stepping stone because although Martin's right, they're not got any chance of winning silverware just now. They have ambitions to do that, and
absolutely,
they also have the resources.
Johnny, to the point on the Scots then, did you feel pain?
Did you feel realism?
You know, because there is a factor here where the disparities between the squads. You know, it struck me when I was discussing with Michael Grant in the preview, Greg, I'm sure you probably feel the same. Adam Lafondra, very much a journeyman from the English Football League, is part of the Hibs squad. He's 36. He was playing at Newport a few years ago. I saw him play against Lincoln, and I was like, Adam Lafondra? Nothing against Adam Lafondra, by the way, if you're listening and watching, but that is the reality of this situation, isn't it?
If I was Adam Lafondra, I would not think that was nothing against him. I wouldn't be sitting there thinking, oh, well, that's nothing against me. You know,
a fine career.
He did.
He was very good. But I didn't expect him to be in the Europa Conference League at 36.
That's my point. Sorry, Adam. Johnny.
I felt... We Scots are quite parochial, so I felt a slight bit of amusement, although I quite like Hibs, but mostly pain. Because this is economic, you know, it has always bugged me that there's a sort of laughter about the Scottish League, this side of the board. And sometimes there's an edge to it that suggests that you guys think that, you know, we're useless at football. And we've sort of made these choices. We've chosen to have our top flight full of journeyman players. It's just economics. Purely economics. I remember being told 20 years ago by a Scottish top flight manager, Dick Campbell at Dunfermline, that he'd just lost a striker he was trying to sign to a non-league club in England, to a conference, because his wages were £1,000 a week. That was 20 years ago, and he couldn't afford them.
It's worse now.
And it's the disparity is much worse now. So that's where we are. If you look at Celtic, Joe Hart and goals, Premier League clubs don't want him anymore. You look at Rangers, maybe their two best players over the last 5 years have been Tavernier and Conor Goldson, superb players for Rangers, but players that haven't got, you know, suitors, the English players, but players who don't have big suitors in England trying to bring them back south of the border. And it just comes down to economics and to wages. And it will continue getting worse. But I suspect, I wasn't there, but I suspect Hibs quite enjoyed playing Aston Villa. And for them, there's a little prize in that in itself. And it'll be a day that their players get to remember. Hoping for Betway and Aberdeen play Häcken of Sweden tonight. And we've got half a chance. But certainly when you draw the English clubs, you don't anymore.
It's also the, you know, Martin was talking about the Battle of Britain thing, where usually they've always involved the Old Firm.
So
now we're talking about the step down from the Old Firm is like...
It is.
I'm a ridiculous guy. Yeah. And the step down in England is not quite the same.
No, that's
a big reason. But Johnny's right. And, you know, you saw John McGinn speaking about this game. He said, like, before the game, you know, don't take it lightly. And, you know, it turned out to be wrong. But he was saying, I take it personally when people start slagging up the Scottish game. And, you know, people can be quite defensive about it.
It shows you the value of, if it needed any more pointing out, the value of the television money. Because, you know, Rangers and Celtic, in terms of footfall, in terms of getting people through the turnstiles, they're up there with anybody. Then you go to the other part of the game to do with television revenue and all of that, and that's where it falls off the cliff, because, you know, you don't get Barngate money alone these days. You can't get Barngate money. You have to have that backup revenue stream of broadcasting.
A little dig in there from Johnny for Joe Hart as well, just to make me feel a little bit better about my
It wasn't the way you buried
that. As you would say, nothing against Joe Hart.
Just to wrap up on this game, of course, you know, we're talking about big broad topics here. On the game itself, hat-trick for Ollie Watkins. Charlotte Dunker is interviewing him, and you can read that piece on the Times website by the time that you're listening to this podcast. Martin, just very quickly on him, what do you make of him as a player? Kind of been in and out of the England reckoning. Do you think this season, it feels like he's, Unai Emery's giving him the chance to be the leading man?
Yeah, absolutely. And Emery's a good manager, and he will improve greatly under Emery, I would imagine. And, you know, with the situation, the short-term situation, at least with Ivan Toney, Gareth Southgate needs backup strikers. And you'd look at Ollie Watson, who's Ollie Watson?
Probably a rugby player.
Yeah, he's a rugby player. But you'd look at him, and you'd look at Callum Wilson, and they're the leaders in the clubhouse.
Yeah, absolutely. Big season for Ollie Watkins, and big season for the Game Podcast. We hope you're enjoying it. If you are, make sure you're subscribed, and you can get all the best of these guys' writings on the Times website now. Just go to times.co.uk/the game for the latest subscription offer.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast. And up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ,
the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
So a brilliant and exciting start to the season for Aston Villa. Definitely not two words that you can attribute to Everton's start to the season. And not just on the pitch, but off it as well. Things took a turn for the worst on Wednesday when MSP Sports Capital withdrew from talks about taking a minority stake in the club. Obviously been very difficult for Everton on the pitch for quite a while and off it. Martin, what did you make of this latest development?
It's Everton, isn't it? I don't know if there's a boardroom equivalent of lads, it's Tottenham, but it'll be lads, it's Everton, wouldn't it? I mean, it's the sort of thing that happens to Everton. Nothing seems to be going right at the football club at the moment. They've got Sean Dyche in and he can't even make them, sort of tight and resilient, which is the one thing you'd think he would be able to do. And they can't even do that. They haven't got a striker. The relationship between the fans and the board is at an all-time low, and I wouldn't have thought this helps it too much. It's just a bad luck zone at the moment in Goodison Park, unfortunately. And, they need money. We don't know what the Football League, the Premier League's verdict is going to be on their finances. It's a mess.
Johnny, on Sean Dyche, is a manager that you know quite well and you've interviewed before. Yeah. How do you think he'll be feeling about this? Because, as Martin said, a lot of people looked at them, Everton, as a situation and thought, perfect man for the job. Sean Dyche, he'll at least get them tight. He'll at least get them solid. It's a struggle.
Yeah, it is a struggle. I mean, I guess one trait he has, which I'm not sure will be a benefit or a curse in this situation, is he's not a manager that looks outside his own club very much. He's pretty tunnel visioned about what he does and likes to focus on that. But he hasn't been able to surmount the issues in that squad so far. The way they leak goals and the way they can't score goals. Two biggest issues facing Everton. Yeah. Reasonable midfield, but the rest of it has been substandard for quite a while. And I think I had the same response watching them against Villa as probably a lot of people did, which was, this will be a long season for them. Flirted relegation the last 2 years, and they don't look like a club that's in any way been able to learn and move on from those in a football sense. But maybe that's linked to the fact that they're kind of, as we've been saying, paralysed in a financial sense as well. But I cannot see anything other than a campaign right at the bottom of the league and a really uncomfortable one, unless they make some kind of miracle signing in the next few days, somebody that's going to score a whole load of goals or some kind of galvanising figure.
And sooner or later they're going to go, because if you hang around in those positions long enough, eventually, it's the old thing about going to a barber's every day, eventually get a haircut. So,
I don't know how they work.
but that's what's going to, I'm sure we've all done games at Everton where this was going to be the game where they went down. This was going to be the season they went down, and somehow they've avoided it.
Yeah.
It can't keep happening.
Gregor, when you look at the squad they have now, thinking to Martin's point and to Johnny's, not just about the struggle at the bottom, but then a potential future in the Football League, and we're writing this very early days, etc., etc. Firstly, is that squad good enough to stay in the Premier League with Sean Dyche as it is now? And then secondly, if it were to drop down, theoretically, how would they cope in the Championship?
Oof, the first one, I think the problem is there's a lot of injuries too, and they're relying on Calvert-Lewin's injured. Seamus Coleman, Dwight McNeil, I think even Jack Harrison, who arrived on loan, is not fully fit just now. There's a sea of red crosses up beside their squad list. And it's, the goals are the massive issue. I think only Wolves scored fewer goals in the Premier League last year. I read only Chelsea underperformed their XG more. So like they're not even, they don't have a finisher. And when they're trying to sign Che Adams to fill that gap, much as I, love Che Adams now.
Honorary Scott.
I'm not sure he's the answer.
Yeah.
So I agree it's going to be touch and go all season for them. And then staying up, it's a huge question, because really it would be, you know, financial Armageddon for them, because I read somewhere that they're paying about $50,000 a week in interest alone, huge debt, and clearly the hearing in October could be pretty decisive for them as well. So, you know, there have been clubs in the past where they drop into the Championship and it's like a reset. But it feels like there's a lot of mess, largely financial, that would make that very difficult, because they've got a new stadium to pay for. Seems to be a kind of a huge web of, you know, financial loans and trying to get the finances in place to actually finish it as well. And then often when you get loans and they're secured against Premier League status, because you have the guarantee of 100 plus million pound coming in every year. When that ends, we have to be repaid. So they cannot even think about going down.
I suppose the only hope, the only hope, but the one hope, the strongest hope that they've got, is that once they get to that new stadium, if somebody from outside can see the potential of that football club in that stadium, that you might get somebody that comes in and says, right, we can do something with this. This place is at rock bottom. We can get it up. We can build this up again. We can build it up from here with this stadium. But you've got to get to the stadium first.
They're still the fourth most successful club in English football. You know, for people my generation and younger, I think that'd be quite, you know, gobsmacking. They're level on Premier League titles in Manchester City. So, like, undoubtedly, what Martin's saying is true. The potential, you know, when you see the investment that's coming in from all over the world in clubs with a view to, you know, bringing them up to a better level. I think just all the all the mess around behind the scenes just now is the problem. And obviously they lost because of the sanctions and one of their sort of backers as well, Ushmanov. That's proved a huge issue for them as well.
How much, Johnny, do you think that is part of the issue? We talk so much on the podcast, and it's been a topic that I've asked you about a lot, about what is your club? What is it? Who are you? And, you know, Martin talks about going up and down. You think about clubs like Fulham, Norwich. They become the clubs that go up and down. Then you have clubs like West Ham, who are a huge club with great history, and they're trying to, you know, they don't want to be the club that goes up and down. Everton, as Craig has just outlined, huge club, great historical standing. The idea that they would then be a club who goes up and down and drops into the Championship, that's tough to take, right?
Very tough to take. Uncharted territory for them, given how long they've been in the top division, really. But what they do have, and we do speak a lot about identity. They are one of the clubs that have got a special identity, I believe. They've got a different identity. That's the potential of them. It's got something, Goodison Park, still that is distinct, that other clubs don't have. And I feel their supporters are almost inexhaustible in their passion, because they've had 25, 30 years of more or less, they haven't had, apart from the Moyes era, but before the Moyes era and after the Moyes era, it's been a club that hasn't matched on the pitch what the supporters bring on the stands. Martin said, if you get to the new stadium and you have this identity and this history and this fan base, you've got something. But people buying football clubs aren't that too sentimental. So while they might see that potential, if there are financial issues that just make it too difficult to do a deal, there's plenty of other clubs you'd do a deal for instead.
And also that you need an owner that spies the potential in the club to be something more than it is. Mike Ashley took over Newcastle and never really got what he had.
And it's not going to be Mashiri, I don't think. I think we've seen enough of them. And you're right about Ashley.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, when I started working in Manchester, so that's the early 80s, one of the first games I went to up there, and I've never forgotten it, was the European Cup Winners' Cup semi-final against Bayern Munich. And that was a fabulous game and just this incredible atmosphere. And you look at that place when they're fighting for their lives, the game against Chelsea, I think it was, and other matches like that. But to see it when they're doing well, to see it when they've got something at stake, and they had Andy Gray knocking seven bells out of Bayern Munich's defence, banging on the I can't remember if it was I think it was the Bayern Munich players, the substitutes and the coaches, banging on the banging on the top of the Everton dugout because they were so angry at the battering that they were getting from Andy Gray. and the whole place just was just taking off. And what you've got to remember is that that team and therefore that club never quite fulfilled its destiny, because English clubs then got banned from Europe. And so just at the point when Everton were ready to really take off, and I realise it's before the start of the Premier League and so it isn't the same financial benefit, but just at that point when they were really ready to take off, suddenly they were confined to domestic football as was everybody else. But what I really remember that night, and I was 20 years old or whatever, just come up from London, just started at the Sunday People, and sitting there thinking, this is magnificent. This is like nothing I've seen before in a football stadium. It was brilliant.
Johnny, absolutely would you brilliant. Agree with that about Goodison Park?
Oh, definitely. And one thing makes me think, this is a club that had Carlo Ancelotti as a manager not long ago.
Yeah.
And even Carlo couldn't.
But that's part of it. That kind clubs. Of goes back to that point about the, what are you? That was part of that difficulty, wasn't it? That they signed all those players, you know, also the Davy Klaassen era, those signings.
So much waste.
Yeah,
so
but that's the thing is then, they, but that fell into the, we're trying to be something that we're maybe not anymore.
I think it's, sadly, it wasn't the aspiration that was wrong. It was the execution, I think, is how history will look at
totally
it.
Agree.
That was a moment where there was money to spend and they did get big managers in and without listing the signings and the kind of, and they're jumping from one thing to another. You know, but how many good managers did they have in that era? It's the way it was, the chaotic way it was executed and the money was spent is the issue.
Well, Everton are definitely going to need those fans this season. And speaking of identity, we're going to move on to talk about captaincy. And Martin, an item in your column on Tuesday on Bruno Fernandes at Manchester United. Tell us more about your views on him as a captain and, you know, what sparked your piece in
that. Well, you know, if you think about captaincy, Glenn Hoddle made Alan Shearer his captain. When he was England manager. And the reason he made Alan Shearer his captain was that he thought it'd get us more penalties. I mean, his logic was, if Alan Shearer was the England captain, Alan Shearer is the guy that is entrusted to speak to the referee and everything. And if he has that relationship with the referee and that sense of trust from the referee that this is England's captain, this is the man that, you know, they give this armband to, the referee will be more inclined to believe him if he goes over in the penalty area. And you can say that's super cynical, and indeed it is, but that's how he saw the role of captaincy. Now,
did it work, Mark?
Well, we didn't win anything, if that's what you mean. But the...
Must go back and check those stats.
Yeah, exactly. But to be fair, you can see with the appointment of Bruno Fernandes that Manchester United are not really going for the winning friends and influencing people angle, because, you know, I don't know anybody apart from Manchester United fans who don't find him the most irritating player. But
even some United fans, I know them. They find him pretty annoying as well.
And I just thought, I was watching him against Tottenham and you know, there was that sort of, it looked like there was a bit of snarkiness with his own teammates sometimes and, you know, with the referee. And you're thinking, mate, you're the conduit between all of these sort of groups of people. Act like it. Mm. You know, you've got to act like it. And Harry Maguire can't get in the team, unfortunately. But, you know, you got the sense that Harry Maguire, with the captain's armband on, was a captain. I realise in other countries, captaincy is not regarded as anything that's particularly important. But I think it is in English football. I think English footballers look towards a leader. I think English managers and coaches, and all coaches, really, like that English, you know, not an English captain necessarily, but that sense of leadership that we regard as important. You know, you hear some of the best continental managers and some of the best brains hand over to their captain 10 minutes before kickoff and say, right, you finish the team talk, you give the team talk.
Yes.
You know, Wenger used to do it on occasions with people like Tony Adams and stuff, and because he could see the impact that he had. Mm. If you want an example, Fabio Capello's, when Fabio Capello gave the captaincy back to John Terry, there were two, three reasons for it. One of them was that they canvassed the younger players. They canvassed the younger players in the squad, the people who just come into the squad. And they followed up and said, since you've been in the squad, have any of the senior players mm-hmm. stayed in touch with you? And they all said, they didn't say Stephen Gerrard's name, they didn't say Rio Ferdinand's name, they said, oh yeah, John Terry called and said that he'd seen me on Match of the Day and what a good performance, and if I carried on like that, right, so that's number one. Mm. Number two, everyone thought that Cabela was furious with John Terry standing up to him in South Africa. He wasn't. His attitude was, he wasn't the captain. Why was it him that went to me and said the fellas would just like to have a beer after a game, you're just to unwind? Mm. Why wasn't it the captain that went to me? And the third one, and I think this is very interesting, is of those three players, he said, when John Terry, when you make him the captain, he becomes a better player. Mm. He said, as soon as you give him the armband, suddenly, right, now I'm the captain, now I'm the leader, and he takes it upon himself. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And I also, which leads into something else, and that's why I was very surprised that there wasn't more of a battle around Declan Rice, because Declan Rice is an obvious captain. And I don't think there's a huge amount of potentially great captains around. And I think that evidenced by the fact that Ten Hag can't see beyond Bruno Fernandes, who's quite a divisive figure on the field.
Johnny, lots to unpack there.
Bruno's a funny one, because from what I understand off the pitch, he's a nice bloke. He's an intelligent guy. He's friends with different corners of the dressing room, but on the pitch, as Martin said, he just isn't a character that even his teammates warm to. He doesn't seem to play better with the armband. He does seem to play for himself a lot of the time. And that's possibly the thing that's stopped him becoming a truly great player, because he's got so much talent. But there's an element of Bruno Fernandes's kind of playing his own game, always has been. This is a team that's got Casemiro and Rafa Varane. And if you want to go in a different direction, you could give it to Marcus Rashford.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it does seem an odd choice. But I think what we found with Ten Hag is he's... maybe stubborn might be a word. He makes his own mind up about stuff and he kind of sticks to it. Captains can come in all shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. You know, look how Martin Odegaard's done for Arsenal. You wouldn't have thought he was going to be a great captain, but he has been a really good one. Mm. But one thing that he's done is he's played better, to speak to that point, with the armband on. And just from a narrow point of view, Bruno Fernandes has not been a better player as Man United captain than he was before it. And that alone might be a reason to give the armband to someone else.
Who was the best captain you worked with, Gregor?
I'm going to ask you who the worst was in a minute, so get your confidence.
Probably, I mean, Des Walker.
Right, best. Yeah.
But, I mean, he's Des Walker. And he's playing for Nottingham Forest in the Championship at the end of his career. He had so much of in the bank that made him clear. He was clearly going to be a big captain for all of us. But there's other players that, you know, you won't have heard of, who I played for. And it's personality, it's leadership, it's respect, and sometimes it's just about being the best player too. So Fernandes kind of falls into a few of them, but not like. Mm. But there's something changes on the pitch, and it's also, you need to be respected by not just people in the changing room, you need to be respected by the referee, by the club, by the opposition, in fact. I think he's got, you know, that's part of it. So I've often thought, I remember writing a piece a while back, sometimes a captain can tell you what a team lacks even as well. I remember when Xhaka was made captain like 5 years ago for Arsenal, it was like, you know, it doesn't matter. Now there's leadership groups. We were talking before, Newcastle have a leadership group because Jamal Lascelles is on the bench, so Trippi is often captain, but they're even sharing out the captain's column among the leadership group on a matchday programme. But something in Arsenal were one where it's kind of, he was voted, I think, by his teammates, but that told you something about what they lacked, and you looked around and there wasn't really any other clear candidates.
Absolutely.
But what Johnny's saying is true. There are people who won World Cups. There are people who are, you know, huge players. And it's like, it felt almost like if he wasn't given it, he perhaps wouldn't have taken it too well. That doesn't feel like a good position from which to choose your captain.
Do you agree, as a former player, to Martin's point about it mattering in the English game, in the British game, you know, to have that leader when you think about the dressing rooms you've been in?
I do, yeah. And I know that, you know, there are people who think that's kind of a bit prehistoric now, considering all the all we're talking about.
Hipster football journalists go, oh no, in Italy they're so sophisticated they just give it the Premier
League,
off.
The Premier League is a global league now, so we say these are English traits, and the Premier League isn't an English league anymore. So I did feel that. I think it said a lot about the team.
Who you picked.
It said it kind of projected an image as well as sort of being someone that you as a team would look up to and feel confident and playing alongside and saying, yeah, he's our leader.
You think about, like Gregor's point, and that there might have been a strop if Fernandes hadn't got it. We don't know that, but there might have been. And then you think of, say, something like Chelsea, where Reece James really wanted the captaincy, and so Mauricio Pochettino, he hasn't got great experience of the squad, has thought, right, this guy really wants it, gives him the captaincy, twang, and now, you know, this is a guy that averages 19 league starts a season for Chelsea. Out of the 38, for the last four seasons, 19 out of 38 matches he starts in the league. So you haven't just lost the right back now, you've lost the captain. Now, you can say, it doesn't really matter, he's only the captain for two matches, what have they lost? But now you've got to find someone else to give the armband to and say, well, you weren't my first choice, but, you know, could you go and lead the team now? I do think it's important.
I think we need an expected captain metric. please, hipsters. I don't think Bruno Fernandes would score very
We've kept the expected metrics out of the podcast a little bit so far this season. Tom Roddy snuck one in the other day, which I nearly threw something at him.
Yeah, we just make Monday the hipster game column, and you know, this is real football.
Proper football men.
Martin, football men.
It's only your second show, and you've already started a warring faction between. Your own podcast.
I wouldn't have thought Kaz was going to be too happy being branded a hipster.
I'll have to get Kaz in on Thursdays instead. Just very quickly, Greg, did you ever made captain of a team, either in a temporary way or in a permanent way?
Once or twice temporary,
How did that feel? Did you like the responsibility? You know, thinking about all you've just said about it embodying what about a team, having that responsibility.
I think you said something about the team.
That they were struggling.
No, that your captain was missing.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, that's another factor. It's like, who's next in line? Yeah. Sometimes, if we're picking a captain. And so I think Chilwell wore it.
Yeah.
With Thiago Silva going.
Neither of those two guys scream at your captain, but they've got a connection to the club. That's another thing. It's it's quite multi-layered, this, but I think the main thing is it says something about the team, both projecting an image to the outside world and to the rest of the dressing room.
Fascinating topic, and yet another one that I'm sure we could do an entire podcast on, the issue of captaincy. Maybe we will. And now it's time for my favourite part of Thursday's show. And Martin, you said about us prepping, and don't let the listeners and viewers know all about it. Well, we've not prepped this bit because we didn't last week, and I enjoyed it so much. It's time to ask you a question from Bill Edgar's weekly fiendishly difficult quiz. See how long the silence lasts this time. It's about Arsenal v Fulham. Arsenal had their Japanese defender Takehiro Tamiyasu sent off on Monday against Crystal Palace. Which Japanese player has appeared for both Arsenal and Fulham early this century?
Yeah, I got it.
We got that.
Come on.
We got that.
Inamoto.
Correct. Well done. I found an easy one.
2002.
Very good.
2002 World Cup. You could not get... You could not get a Japanese shirt. You couldn't get an Arsenal shirt. Because they did well, didn't they? And he started scoring. And I was out in Japan and you walked into their sports shop. I remember writing this piece about the history of football in Japan, and the amazing thing was they had a football shirt shop about 10 years before they had a proper Japanese league with foreign players in it, and also they had this football shop from about the early 70s, and it went in there and you had Gerd Müller's golden boot and stuff like that. It was just amazing, very Japanese sort of place, you know, this fixation with collecting things. And the only shirt you could buy in there, and they only had a couple of them left, was god-awful Arsenal away kit that was like yellow and blue, terrible, like diamonds, millions of them, or triangles.
Probably
and,
be a collector's item if you got
absolutely.
One,
yeah. And because everybody had bought up every single Japanese shirt and every single Arsenal first team shirt to put in the motor on the back. People were jumping off bridges and stuff like that to celebrate, jumping into the river. All these students jumped into the river to celebrate Japan winning their match. Absolutely fascinating stuff.
Certainly a cult figure. I'm huge relief to know that you got that one right. Yeah. I got 8 out of 10, by the way, on the full quiz. So make sure you test yourself and let me know on Twitter how you got on. And we're going to finish the show, guys, talking about Ben Foster. Announced his second retirement from football at the age of 40, having conceded 13 goals in 4 matches for Wrexham, Gregor. Finding life a bit difficult in the Football League, as well as his team. You wrote a piece about his retirement. The right decision?
I mean, it sounds like it, looking at the goal record. Looking at Paddy's shipped 5 twice in the opening 4 league games. I mean, I have sympathy. This is, you know, there are many things we discuss in this podcast about which I have no experience. I can't give much kind of, but one is your legs going. Or in this case maybe his arms too, just how horrible it is when your body no longer moves as quick as your mind. And clearly that's what he's saying. He's saying I would have saved some of these shots a few years ago. And it's fascinating, as we were discussing before, that that's still the case in League 2 from former England international. And that, you know, Wrexham as well are finding out that no matter how much money you have, it's not going to be a walk in the park in England's fourth team.
Yeah, I mean, it's a league, Martin, that is not just high standards on the pitch, but off the pitch. The attendances are high.
Tranmere versus Salford, just under 10,000 people at Tranmere, and Salford don't get huge gates, so that's not a massive influx of away fans necessarily. That's all about people wanting to go to Tranmere. There was a Wrexham's gate was over 10,000. There was another one. Doncaster got, I think, 8,500 or nearly 9,000. They're the 91st out of 92 clubs at the moment, Doncaster Rovers. Getting, you know, and with no sort of pedigree of, oh, they were, you know, it's not like Bradford where you go, well, they were in the Premier League at one stage. You know, it's Doncaster Rovers. And so I just think, the other thing that you take away from that as well is that the Wrexham project, what makes the Wrexham project special and important is that actually it's based in reality. You know, it's reality television, the show, but it's not a reality television club. It's actually still got to be run as a League Two club. And if there was any at all motivation that Ben Foster has got this great YouTube channel and everything like that, if there was even that much of a thought, well, that would be quite handy. He's comfortable in front of a camera or whatever. It gets very, very quickly dispelled when you ship 5 goals in 2 of your matches, and suddenly it's, we need a League 2 goalkeeper. We need somebody that is going to, is quick enough and agile enough to survive in this league.
I remember my final season at Grimsby Town in the National League. I would have been 33. And I'd been injured and I came back and I was on the bench because we'd signed someone on loan in my absence.
Right.
Connor Townsend, who's now at West Brom.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And it's the first time in my life, because you always, 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 no matter what, every professional thinks they should be in the team.
Yeah.
And this is the first time in my life watching this game, watching Connor Townsend bombing down the left from left back, whipping crosses, like a couple of assists. I thought, I shouldn't be in this team.
Yeah.
And that's a horrible feeling.
He's
obviously getting to this point, even if it's in 14
and in training football, as well, when you're just like playing against people.
I'm holding the team back here, or there's someone who actually could do a better job than me.
You mentioned that loan move from someone like Connor Townsend down to the National League. Do you think that plays a part in the standards being a little bit higher, you know, and also financially as well? We were talking earlier about investment, people taking a chance on Everton. This is a subject we've discussed on the game before. You know, people with money are looking to the Football League now for a bit of fun, for a bit of investment, and for a chance of the journey up the pyramid.
Look all across the league, and particularly from the US. I think Gillingham now won the first 4 games 1-0.
Yep.
They've got
top of League 2.
US ownership, and they spent a lot of money. They spent a lot of money in January to kind of haul them out from the relegation trouble to easy safety. So yeah, absolutely, the standards have been raised all the time. And just looking at some of the attendance figures from last year, League 2 was the 14th best support league in Europe. Mm-hmm. League 1 was in the top 10, and the Championship was 5th behind Premier League, Bundesliga, La Liga and Serie A. So like, there's, I don't think there's anywhere who's got the same sort of level of support and, you know, professionalism, investment, depth of quality as in English football.
Scouts said something interesting to me about a year ago, which was the last 15 years have seen this huge investment in academies and the EPPP, which is effectively, if you think about, we've got an industry where we've had a decade and a half of ever more people being put onto the job market, young graduates coming out of these places, equipped, skilled. But the number of jobs has stayed the same in this industry because it's 92 clubs and squads are pretty much the same size. So it's natural. He was talking in the context of wastage and how many kids are going to fall by the wayside. Mm. But it's just natural there's going to be a filter down where those job places is ever more competition to get even into a League Two squad from players who are very, very talented. Mm. And standards clearly are rising.
Yeah, you see, in cup tournaments now and stuff, if a Premier League team rests half of its players, they get beat. Mm. You know, it's no longer the people say, "Oh, everyone rests players, everyone does." Yeah. But actually, if you look at an Everton, say, and then they go, "Right, we're playing in the cup, but we've got a chance to survive here. We'll rest 8 players." They go to someone in League One or they go to someone in the Championship and they get turned over. It's as simple as that, because the gap is, it's not as big. Mm. You know, I know it's big when you come up and Luton Town are going to find it hard and Sheffield United are finding it hard. But at the same time, in those one-off games, and you see cracking players in the lower leagues. Whenever it's the FA Cup third round and you suddenly get this attention on the lower leagues, you'll see a match and you'll see a kid playing or you'll see someone play and you'll think, blimey, he's got a League Two, isn't he? But must have a League One, isn't he, that fella? I think it's exactly as Johnny says, that, people filter down the league. Yeah. You know?
Do you think that, just final word on this, in terms of that talent and, not just your Connor Townsend point as when you were a player, but looking at it now and obviously former teammates and things who are working in the game maybe as coaches and things, do they tell you that the standards are a bit higher, the technical abilities a bit more? Because I think to Johnny's point about the agent, maybe the other thing is that when Premier League clubs are loaning players out, they're going, well, do you play how we want this kid to play?
Absolutely.
Is that a factor as well in terms of the standard getting higher?
Yeah, undoubtedly the standards getting higher, and because people I played with in the Championship, the league is unrecognisable. And part of that's to do with investment in the Premier League and players trickling down. Part of that, as Johnny's saying, is to do with the development of talented players as well in the academies. So unquestionably, the standards raising all the time. I dread to think what division I would have played in if I was starting out now.
I reckon you'd have easily made it into League Two.
But the point is true as well about how football is being played, because to your team, Lincoln, for example, when Michael Appleton was in charge, he easily got players from Manchester City or Premier League teams, Brennan Johnson from Forest, because they knew he played in a certain style of football. So that's a big part of it. And loans can transform a team season. Absolutely, it can be the difference.
Absolutely.
My wife's cousin, Charlie Lee, was the captain of Tottenham's youth team all the way through and was really regarded as one of their best young prospects, but wasn't quite good enough to play for Tottenham. But I had a career at Peterborough and Millwall and Gillingham later on and had a very good career. And that was Tottenham's youth team captain. Now, you think of years gone by, if you were Tottenham's youth team captain, you'd eventually get in and play for Tottenham. But now you've got this influx of foreign players and stuff like that. It's so much harder to get into those teams. So Charlie ended up playing lower division football all his career. And had a good career. Mm. Had a good Leighton Orient and had a good career all the way through. Yeah. But he was Tottenham's youth team captain.
Yeah, absolutely. Lots and lots of talent in the Football League. So a little plea to go and watch your local team maybe this weekend, if you can get a ticket.
You can't get a ticket.
Yeah, if you can get a ticket.
Go ahead and watch Adam Lafondra.
Exactly, Adam Lafondra.
Yeah.
Top player. Great talent. We'll leave it there. Thanks, yeah. Johnny.
He's on his way down a bit.
Thanks, Chas, for reminding me of that one. Just thought I'd got away with it. Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft, and Gregor Robson. Thank you for joining me. Stick with us. Make sure you subscribe. And on Monday, Tony Cascarino and the Hipsters will be back.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.